This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And I want you to discover the future of trading with IBKR Desktop, Interactive Brokers' next generation trading tool. Built from the ground up, IBKR Desktop combines powerful features with unique sets of groundbreaking trading tools in a streamlined, intuitive interface. You get access to over 150 markets. With IBKR Desktop, you get global stocks, options, futures, currencies, bonds, and funds at your fingertips. But wait, there's more. IBKR Desktop includes innovative features like multi-sort, which lets you sort data using multiple factors simultaneously, helping you to quickly discover and identify trading opportunities. And the option lattice, which visually highlights key metrics for smarter decisions. Now, whether you're a seasoned pro or maybe you're just starting out, IBKR Desktop redefines what traders can expect from a trading platform. Experience the future of trading today. And, you know, whether you're located here in the U.S. or maybe in Australia or even Germany, you'll be pretty impressed with the power of IBKR Desktop. Download IBKR Desktop at ibkr.com/desktop. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
An 800,000 revision to the jobs report. That's a big error. Fed minutes show a likely cut at the next meeting. The U.S. dollar drops hard on the news, and the yen breaks 145. Our guest this week, Carly Garner, senior commodity market strategist and broker at DeCarlyTrading.com. All this and much more on episode number 883 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome to another great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. Here we are towards the end of August, actually the last show of the month, and a lot of things have happened this month, a lot of ups and downs, a lot of crazy numbers. Boy, oh boy, this 800,000 revision of jobs. What do we make of that? Hey, I'm Andrew Horowitz, and again, thanks for joining me this week. Go check out all there is to find over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I get emails from you all the time. If you want to go and send me a question, a request, a comment, you love it, you hate it, whatever it is, go on over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And you know, in fact, if you're interested in looking at all the different strategies that we manage and how we manage it, it's there as well. So you can go to that site. I'm not going to say it again, or should I? TheDisciplinedInvestor.com. It's not like one of those radio guys. And check it out. I do that so that you can know how to actually get in touch and ask me questions on any subjects you want or find out more. So what is going on with this huge revision? It happened on Wednesday. This is a thing that happens each and every year. They go out and they look at the surveys that they do, the standard governmental employment numbers, you know, where we get those reports on the first Friday of the month, and it's like, okay, we added 145 or this or that. The unemployment rate is this or that. Right now, sitting at about 4.3%, but that may change. We'll see. The revision comes as the data comes in because a lot of it is preliminary and it's gathered statistically and it's reviewed. And this 800,000 revision that I'm talking about, by the way, is a downward division. So instead of making all the jobs we thought and the economy was doing well, and the narrative has been that, you know, the jobs numbers are holding up really strong. Look at all the gains that we have. In fact, 800,000 people were actually never employed. That's right. And you're saying to me, how? What? Wait a minute. How did that happen? How do we get a situation where we thought we would have all these people employed and really didn't? Because when we look at how they calculate and do the statistical analysis of the jobs numbers, without getting into the nitty-gritty and the mud on this, the fact is a lot of it is estimation based on certain data. and the revision that they have to do is the process assumes these revisions will happen. But this time, the 800,000 revision, it's like a 60 or 70% decrease in the jobs that were added over the last year. That's a big difference. And dare I say, a big error. When that number came out, we saw the dollar come down pretty hard. We saw a lot of things dumping. The markets had no idea what to do on Wednesday. It was down, it was up, it was down, it was up. The idea that this soft number would then go hand in hand with a Fed that will be a lot more able to drop rates. In fact, we saw the Fed minutes come out also on Wednesday, big day Wednesday. Friday also, of course, we saw the speech from Powell, just a regurgitation of what we expected. But the Fed minutes showed that there was an expectation by the vast majority of members that were voting that during the next policy meeting, which is next month, that we would see a reduction in about 25 basis points, assuming the data came in as expected, which they believed it would. One of the things that we're seeing is more data confirmation that there is a slowdown that is happening through the jobs numbers. We're also seeing confirmation of that that the Fed won't necessarily look at, but from companies like Home Depot and Lowe's. You look at the big box department stores, same thing. We're seeing the discount stores do very well, like a Ross Stores, a TJX. But in total, a lot of them are talking about how people are shopping for bargains and they're looking for price discounts and they're slowing down. Walmart talked about how shoppers are there, but they're looking for lower cost alternatives. Now, the dollar dropped on this news, which you would expect that to happen. And it broke the yen at the 145 level, which is not going to make Japanese markets too happy, we know. This is the concern that I've been having. Even though nothing terrible necessarily happened last time, it was a one-day wonder. But this is my concern that this yen carry trade that will be just bought back into, which it was right after that Monday, and where we saw a trend of 8 or 9 days up on major indices that we don't see very often. Usually there's a break here or there. But what happened was that usually when that happens, there's a good market that follows. But we have to look at all the data. We have to look at all the things that are coming into play right now and the slowdown that is happening. And then now it's starting to slow down at a much greater rate is a 25 basis point that has already been priced in for months, maybe even close to a year at this point, almost a year. It was last October, November. So we're talking about, 10 months that this has been priced into the markets. In fact, it was priced in that 7 cuts was going to happen. We know that. So what's happening now is that we're seeing that things are starting to slow. We saw that oil dropped dramatically. Part of it was because the concern about demand cut below the 72 support level. And with that, we also saw that the concern about overall consumers was slowing. Yes, we saw manufacturing has slowed down in the Philly Fed. A lot of areas around the country in terms of the localized and more regional areas of manufacturing have slowed, generally speaking. Housing prices somewhat held up, but more time on the market. And we're seeing things like used car prices dropping. And we're seeing that, again, people are going for things that are less expensive. That all adds up to a slowdown. Will it be recessionary? The markets are still betting that it will be a soft landing. We like to use these terms. It'll be a soft landing. In other words, a slowdown without a negative GDP print. That's what the hope is. That's what the markets are betting on. And what we saw was, again, this very reflexive trade for looking for those areas like small caps that will do well if rates come down. But I got to tell you, you got to wonder who's buying all the small caps, even though rates are coming down, if they believe that the slowdown is happening. What they believe is growth will happen. Growth will continue, but at a slower rate. So instead of a 4% GDP, maybe we'll have a 2% or a 1%, but we're still going to have growth. They believe that companies can weather this storm, that the U.S. consumer will be there. One of the great things that we're seeing, generally speaking, is that emerging market currencies have been doing really well. This is something we've been planning on all year with the idea that rates will come down and invested our clients' portfolios accordingly. Because you get that tailwind of a dollar that's going lower, other currencies against it, of course, going higher. That's a real big benefit for countries like in the Asia Pacific, Latin America, and even emerging Europe. The euro has hit the lowest point in a year. All this is because of one thing. The U.S. is slowing. And then you have to scratch your head and wonder, okay, if all that is the case and we're seeing that there is a need to reduce rates and there is an obvious slowdown, why the heck are we pricing in such a dramatic price-earnings ratio for markets? Close to over 20 again, average being about 15, recessionary times maybe 12. So if we're not going into a recession, but we are going into a slowdown, are we supposed to be at a PE ratio of 20 or so for an outlook on markets when there is a slowdown that is approaching that everybody agrees on? What is it? It's the idea that more stimulus will be coming. It's the idea that the rates will come down and that'll be good. But unfortunately, I think there's a lot of people that have this wrong. They have it wrong because they don't realize that when a slowdown happens, people are less likely to pay up substantial prices for things. And one of those things is stocks. Stocks that in the next 6 to 12 months may in fact see a slowing in their overall earnings. People won't pay up for that. Now, maybe the price earnings ratio won't go down to 12, but how about a 17? Even with the lower rates, it doesn't really support a PE ratio and a multiple this large, considering the outlook by everyone is that the economy is slowing. Even if the economy does in fact stay outside of recession, the economy is slowing. That has a lot of effects on a lot of areas, one of them being commodities. And we have a great guest this week that I want to bring on. And I think we're going to do that. I think we're ready right about now. And as mentioned, our guest today is Carly Garner. And we're going to be talking about commodities. And we're going to be talking about the ins and outs of what that whole market is all about, something we really don't talk about that often. Carly, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing with the heat out in Las Vegas?
Well, I mean, we're doing the best we can. We're surviving. That's all we can do.
I hear you. Listen, I want to start with, you haven't been on for a while. I want to start with going back to as far as you can remember to ask you this question. How did you get into the commodity trading business?
Okay. Honestly, I didn't plan on this life. And sometimes I question why I chose this life because the commodity markets are really brutal, to be honest. But I just stumbled across it. So I was one of those kind of college students that didn't really know what they wanted. I changed majors several times. I ended up getting 2 degrees, one in accounting and one in finance. I really hated accounting. So finished, I decided to get finance as well. And I started out as a stock. I didn't start out as a stockbroker. I did an internship with a stock brokerage here in town. I'm in Las Vegas and I hated it. It was a lot of selling. I'm not a salesperson. I never will be. And it just wasn't for me. So I literally just pulled up a jobs website. And the first thing I saw was commodity broker. And that was it.
That's
how I got into it.
That was it.
I tried it.
Wow.
It's dumb luck, but it worked.
It's exciting. I mean, there's a lot of movement. It's not like this is not the kind of thing that you're saying, it's like my job is like watching paint dry. That's not commodity trading.
Oh, no, it is not. Sometimes I'm so exhausted. I would love to watch paint dry, but but at the same time, it never gets boring. So I love what I do. Absolutely. But it does get tiring because things are always moving. There's really the market's open. I don't know. A lot of people don't know this, but the futures markets, the commodity markets open at Sunday evening and they basically trade roughly around the clock until Friday. So we really don't have a lot of downtime.
Yeah. The only time that that's one of the reasons why between me and you, I always decided not to trade cryptocurrency during the heyday because I knew I would never sleep.
Yeah. We need our weekends. I mean, geez.
Exactly. Thank God it's closed. Yeah, exactly. and how do you deal with, before we get into some of these other areas, how do you deal with some of the risk with that particular issue with the idea of overnight holds. You know, you're holding on to, you have a good position on, let's say, I'm just going to pick this out of the blue, on oil on the long side. And all of a sudden overnight, you know, you got somebody in somewhere saying, you know what, we're going to increase production. And you wake up in the morning and all of a sudden what? So how do you deal with that overnight risk?
Well, I mean, so that's a good question. I mean, there's really no, other than being out of the market and being flat and not participating, that's really the only way to truly manage the risk. But we do, with our clients, like we're a boutique brokerage shop. So we have clients that are trading all different strategies and contracts and types. What we encourage them to do is option trading. And mind you, option trading is complicated, so I'm not gonna be able to get into it here, but as an option buyer, your risk is limited. We generally are doing option spreads where there is some unlimited risk component, but we usually put it, for example, if we're going to have a strategy that has unlimited risk, we make sure it's at a price that, I mean, it's possible, but it's very unlikely to be seen. And then we you know, sleep well at night hoping that something like that doesn't happen. But I've been in this business long enough to know that, you know, every handful of years we do get a black swan. And actually the last 4 years, we've had multiple black swans, which has been really, really interesting to be in this business. You know, sometimes that's, it is what it is. You have to pay to play, and part of paying to play is accepting that risk. The reality is though, I mean, I know it's comforting thinking the markets are closed and you can't make or lose money when the markets are closed, but not necessarily true. Because if you think about it, like when you close your computer, if you're just trading stocks or holding stocks, if you close your computer on Friday, a lot can happen over the weekend. There's no guarantee your stock portfolio is going to be exactly the same price it was on Friday on Monday morning. So it does change whether or not you actually are in a market that's open or not. But most of us don't think of it that way.
Yep. So what tools do you use to help you find trading ideas? Whether that's, I don't know what even... There's a gamut of things I know you could use, but what is it that you really, you personally like?
So I look at, I look at a handful of things. I tend to be an analyst that focuses on market positioning, seasonality, and the charts as opposed to fundamentals. I don't ignore fundamentals, but the reality is, especially in commodities, sometimes the fundamentals can be misleading because by the time the fundamental story is the most compelling is when the trend is probably over. I'll give you an example. In 2022, when natural gas was at $9 or $10, everybody assumed everyone in Europe was going to freeze. They weren't going to have enough natural gas. The U.S. couldn't export it. There was all these supply concerns and all these big, you know, headlines all over the tape. Yeah. Reality is that's exactly when the market topped out and natural gas went from $10 to $2.
Again, so you have to be careful. Again, natural gas is an amazing thing to me, which we could talk about in a minute. That seems like it should have so much more legs than it does. But when you talk about the positioning, so that I'm going to make an assumption and you can clarify, but you would rather look at, for example, the commitment of traders and over the actual weekly inventory numbers, maybe let's say, for oil.
Correct. Yeah, this is not your first rodeo. You know exactly what you're talking about. The COT report is something I follow very, very closely. And what the commitment of traders is basically the CFTC. It's a government agency. They take data on which groups of traders, and they categorize them by large speculator, small speculator, and commercial hedgers. And they basically tell us where that group is positioned and how big or small their position is. And so what we look for is overheated markets. Like this sounds overly simplistic, but it works. So until it stops working, we'll keep using it. But basically the idea is with large speculators who are considered those with deep pockets, they're the smart money, quote unquote, smart money. When their position size gets really, really excessive, whether they're long or short, usually the trend's about to end. And it's really as simple as, regardless of the fundamentals, regardless of what the latest inventory report is, if everybody has already reacted and traded on their opinion, there's nobody left to buy or nobody left to sell at the end of the trend. And it reverses itself. And then all those people that are long have to sell to get out and vice versa. And the market generally reverses to some sort of a mean pretty quickly.
I always say it's something like if you're on a boat and all of a sudden the boat starts shifting a little bit and everybody gets on one side of the boat and then it shifts really a lot and then everybody runs to the other side of the boat again, it gets really right. overly done. And that's kind of how I look at all of that. But I have two questions for you. First, just popped into my head. I heard you were on Tommy Grisafi's show in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, he's been a guest host of Cow Guy Clothes on RFD TV a handful of times. So just about, I think it was a week or two ago, I talked to Tommy on that show, but I've been on his podcast as well. I think that was a couple of months ago I did his podcast.
I haven't talked to Tommy in a long time. He's been on my show several times over the years.
He's a good guy.
Crazy dude, but good guy. I like him a lot. So the other thing is, this is a strange question. And this may go against everything because this is what you do, but I don't know, maybe not. What is your feeling about having commodity futures that speculators could buy? I'm not talking about the hedgers, right? I'm not talking about your farmer who is looking at his crops of corn and he's putting on some futures trades because he needs to even out the potential of what's going to happen this year, right, during this harvest. Okay. Mm-hmm. Versus speculators who are moving stuff all around and they are effectively changing the price of my food. For the profit motive. Do you find that upsetting?
Well, I don't, probably because I'm a futures broker. So I actually, I make my living off that, but I'll also explain a couple other things. I can totally understand and appreciate that perspective. And I hear that a lot. The reality is, like, if you look at commodity markets that don't have futures markets attached to them, so they don't have speculators bringing liquidity. Speculators basically bring liquidity to the markets so the hedgers can offset their price risk. So that's their function. If you look at markets, let's say, for example, like olive oil or eggs, you know, markets that don't really have viable futures markets that speculators are participating in, those markets actually are quite a bit more volatile than corn and soybeans. I know it's hard to believe because you look at corn, you see we went from $8 to $3.50, $3.80, and you think that without speculators, that wouldn't have happened. But it's actually not true. If you look at markets that don't have speculators, it's even worse when it comes to volatility. But I'll also say, I will agree 100% that speculators will, in the short run, push prices beyond where they might have gone without all the speculative frenzy. So if you're looking at crude oil, a couple of years ago, crude probably wasn't going to break 110 if we didn't have everybody and their dog trying to hedge inflation and throwing money at crude oil futures. Mm-hmm. It pushed it from 110 to 130. So yes, it did push it out of bounds a little bit, but it happens on the downside too. A few years before that, like if you look at 2020, crude oil probably didn't have any business getting below maybe 27, 28. And sure enough, we went
negative 40
teens.
Like negative
exactly.
40, didn't we?
The front month went into negative. Yeah.
That was weird.
That's a little bit, it was weird. And honestly, there weren't a whole lot of people trading at that time because that contract was expiring that day. So most brokerages had locked everybody out of it anyway. But yes, it did happen in a handful of trades did happen down there. So speculators go on both directions. But the thing is, nobody complains when they push the price lower. They only complain when it pushes it higher.
Yeah,
so
naturally.
It balances out. Yeah.
Naturally. So, all right, let me take a quick break and I want to talk to you, get back to this. I want to talk about some of the because I've been talking about this whole thing with the yen and the carry trade and what's going on with this and what maybe not totally what happened, but I got to ask the question, could it happen again? That's coming up too. And I want to talk about some other things that we've been looking at. Now, I think we talked about natural gas a second ago. A lot of people talking about gold. So hang on, we'll be right back. And we're going to interrupt this to talk about IBKR, Interactive Brokers again. Because I want you to discover the future of trading with IBKR Desktop, Interactive Brokers' next generation trading platform. You know, I've told you a lot about this, but you really need to know that it's built from the ground up, which is really important. IBKR Desktop combines the powerful features that they have, several dozens of them, with a unique set of groundbreaking tools in a streamlined, intuitive interface. And whether you're a seasoned pro or maybe you're just starting out, well, IBKR Desktop redefines what you can expect from a trading platform. Experience the future of trading today. Download IBKR Desktop at ibkr.com/desktop. All right, we're back with Carly Garner from DeCarlyTrading.com. It's D-E-Carly, C-A-R-L-E-Y, trading.com. We'll have all the information on her and all of her books. You wrote so many books. How many books have you written?
I know. Well, it's complicated because some of them have multiple editions. I think if you count all of the editions, I think I'm up to 8. So it's way too many.
I've done 2 and I said, you know what? That's that. Yeah. That's that. That's that. That's that.
It's hard. It's yeah. hard.
Because anytime, I don't know about you, but I'll just say about my experience, it never feels like you're ever actually going to be done. Because every time I read it and read it over, I'm like, oh, let's make this change.
100%. Yeah.
It's like you finally one day have to say, okay, that's enough. All right. Let's talk about the yen, shall we? There was a situation that happened and had been happening. I just pulled up a chart on this from 2022 on a monthly basis, just to kind of just get a glance at what was going on. Basically, since 2022, the yen has been in a downward spiral, even though, you know, the commentary from the Bank of Japan and all the other parties over there are saying that they're watching it closely and they don't want to go above this. It shot up very significantly and regularly since then. Then we have people basically what? They're short the yen, they're borrowing it, they're buying dollars, and then they went a little bit crazy buying all sorts of other things. Tell me what you think about what happened, and also what's the chance that this is not over yet?
Okay, so I'm going to say something that might be controversial. The Bank of Japan's monetary policy is really, really aggressive. It's, in my opinion, it's almost as crazy as what we've seen like China do. And let's keep in mind, China has built fake cities just to keep their economy going.
I've seen those, by the way. I've like literally personally driven past 50 miles of those.
Yeah, it's wild. So what I'm saying is the Bank of Japan is not that much more sane than China, in my opinion. Now, what they've done is really, really wildly aggressive. I mean, obviously, they've had negative interest rates for years, propping their economy up. Their stock market has been rallying in recent years, but for a decade or more, really didn't do anything. So all that stimulus was kind of going to waste. But anyway, to make a long story short, a few things that we're noticing in the yen carry trade. Basically, people were borrowing at the yen because the interest rates were low or even negative, and they were using that money to buy assets. A lot, I'm assuming, just based on price action. A lot of it went into U.S. stocks, maybe even U.S. tech stocks. And that's a really dangerous amount of leverage in the system. So something that worked really, really well for a long time, obviously suddenly got a little bit of a jolt a week or so ago. And my personal opinion is we're not done. I've seen this before. I don't want to scare anybody, but we had something very similar in 2007, 2008, right before the financial crisis. The yen carry trade became very, very popular. And the exact same thing was happening. Everybody was short yen. Everyone was long stocks. And one day that started to unwind, and we had this really big initial unwind. It actually was a lot slower back then than it was. I mean, in today's age with electronic trading, things are just much quicker. But we had a kind of a big unwind of the yen carry trade in 2007, and then it relaxed for a couple of months. And then suddenly all the big things started happening. So basically what it did is it changed the trend. So the yen stopped going down and started going up, even though it was a pretty wild ride, just like what we're seeing now. And it was the top of the stock market as well. The stock market topped out and started selling off. And so I'm not saying we get a financial crisis. What I'm saying is I've seen this play out before, and I don't think we're done. I think that was just kind of the warning shot, what we saw a few weeks ago. And then I think at some point in the next couple of weeks, or maybe even a couple of months, maybe it takes a while for that to materialize, I think we'll see the remainder of the unwind.
You know, you said that you're going to say something that's controversial, not in this podcast right now, because I got to be honest with you. I have said that the Bank of Japan has been, I don't even think bordering on, I think outright reckless with their aggressive stance, and almost to a point of persuading people to do things way outside the range of what is safe. I really do.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. And the thing is, I feel like, again, you know, I hope I don't offend anyone, but I feel like a lot of the people running the central banks and the governments, they're very academic. And so they're working off equations and things like that. But what they're underestimating is the risk of human behavior and panic and emotions and things like that. And that can get out of hand really quickly. When that starts to happen, math or equations don't matter. So,
which is the equivalent of self-driving, self-automated right. driving. You know, you can have all these great automated drivers that are just driving down the street, but you have some idiot that decides to, I don't know, you know, he spills coffee on his lap, turns the wheel to the left and smashes right into you.
Yeah, correct.
So, okay. So let's talk about, you know, one of the things I think that you are have been looking at is the idea that there's been a lot of complacency out there. The idea that people are just like, okay, stocks always go up. Stonks, we'll even go stonks. Stonks always go up. Markets always go up. You know, there's little things here and there. But when they do see those downdrafts, buying opportunity. Like we saw 12% down on the Nikkei one day, 10% the next day. Don't even tell me that was retail on the upside. I don't want to hear it. It was absolutely the invisible hand. But okay, not to be weird about it, but come on. You know, you don't get freaked out and get blown out and all of a sudden just buy in the next day as an individual. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
But complacency. Where are your thoughts on this market cycle where we are from an equity or stock standpoint and where people are positioned?
Well, I'm worried. And the reason I'm worried is, like you just mentioned, I think we're just drunk on complacency. And what I mean by that is, I talk to a lot of retail traders for a living. And while they're talking to me about their commodity and futures and options trading, they're also mentioning things that they have going on elsewhere. And I can tell you, it's become very, very popular for them, the retail sector, to be participating in things I don't think they fully understand. I really don't. So for example, triple leverage ETFs, especially in things like tech stocks. I talk to a lot of them that are just habitually selling puts in the SPY, SPX, and they don't understand volatility risk. And so, again, I think what we saw a few weeks ago with the big sell-off, I think that was just kind of a warning shot. I think that I think there's a lot more of that to come. Because I think, you know, when markets sell off and then rebounds as quickly as they did, people don't have to feel as much pain as they probably should have. And I don't mean that in a mean way. What I'm saying is, like, people that triggered margin calls, suddenly the market took them off margin call 2 days later. They didn't even have to wire money. So now they're just kind of emboldened and they're really not respecting the risk. And I'm old enough to remember what it felt like in the financial crisis. And again, I'm not saying we get a financial crisis. I'm just saying, with the stock market as high as it is, in my opinion, fundamentally and technically overvalued, we're in a situation where if something does go wrong, the risk is far outweighs the reward. So right. You're trying to squeeze out a few extra points on the upside, but the risk might be, who knows, 20, 30, 40%, who knows.
And then when you add that to the concept that there is all this borrowing that goes on to buy the stocks through things like a carry trade, you know, that's a problem. You know, you have a multiplier effect on all this that could really be very jolting to the system. So how do you hedge this? How do you besides saying I'm out, right? How do you kind of get yourself so that there's a balance there and potentially some protection?
Right. So I will add one more thing. You're right. So I think there's a lot of leverage that we can't see. Another thing that I have been made aware of is there seems to be some sort of trend towards people pulling equity out of their house and putting it in the stock market. Oh. And that's an accident waiting to happen. We've seen this before. Again, 2006 through 2008, we saw this. I even saw credit cards that are basically, they're kind of like debit cards, actually, that are written against your home equity. So you're, anyways, it's all bad. Okay. So with that said, if you want to give yourself a chance to make money, if the stock market keeps going up, you don't want to cash out, you still want to earn the dividends, whatever it is, you don't want a taxable event, you can hedge. And what we've been helping our clients do is hedge with options on using the E-mini S&P options. We can basically sell call options that are out of the money and buy put options also out of the money. And so what it does is, I'll give you an example. Before the sell-off, I'm not saying we have perfect timing. It was just kind of just happened to work out nicely. But before the sell-off, we were having our clients sell December 6,100 calls. And at the time, the market was at roughly 5,700, somewhere in there, the S&P. So we were giving their portfolios 400 points in appreciation potential. Mm-hmm. And then we're using the proceeds, like it's a free trade because we're selling a call, taking in the money, and then we're using the money to buy 5,100 puts. So what we did is we had a put, basically an insurance policy of prices going below 51 for free. We didn't have to pay for it because that's the expensive thing. A lot of people want to buy insurance against their portfolio. They buy puts and they just keep rebuying them and rebuying them and rebuying. You might only need those puts once a year, maybe once every 2 years. In the meantime, you're spending a whole lot of money to put those in place. It really doesn't make sense. So instead of doing it that way, you can sell a call, buy a put, you do it for free. It doesn't cost you anything. The only thing that it costs you is if the market goes above 6,100, you give up those gains on your portfolio. So you just no longer benefit from anything above 6,100, but that's a really fair trade. Now, you don't want to do that sort of thing on a sell-off. So you do it when you can, not when you have to. You don't want to try to put that strategy right on after the market's dropped 700 points. That's a bad idea.
Actually, that strategy, just to talk about the other way around, market up 700 points, theoretically, yep, that's also when you want to put it on because you're going to get correct the benefit of the, yep, the call premium will be a lot higher and your put yep cost is going to be a lot lower.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So those trades that we did in December, those hedges, most of our clients took them off on, to be 100% honest. Most of them took it off early, which, and I wasn't against it because it seemed like a good idea. But basically the calls lost almost all their value very, very quickly. And then we had one of the biggest spikes in the VIX ever.
That was unbelievable. Yeah. What was that?
Why, and how that was wild. How silly.
Full disclosure, yeah, I shorted the VIX at about 55.
Good for you.
Yeah, and made a few 100% on that.
Good for you. Yeah, that was amazing. So anyone long puts, even if they never became in the money, those puts exploded. I had, this is a separate story, but just to give you an idea of how crazy it was, I had a guy that I talked to on Thursday before the big drop, and he was shopping around for a 4,800 put for September. So I think it was like 90 days or maybe not quite 90 days, probably more like 45 days now that I think about it. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It was a 4,800 put. I quoted him $500. He basically said, I'm going to think about it. And he contacted me on Monday morning wanting to buy it for $500. I said, it's no longer $500.
What is it, like, you want to buy grand? That?
No, it was $9,500. I mean, I couldn't even believe the quote when I looked at it. That was crazy.
Wow.
So,
wow. Yeah. Now these are, by the way, just to be clear for everybody listening, these are indexes. Options on futures contracts.
Right. Right.
Yeah. These are not options on, let's say, SPY, although you could do that too, but a different way. You could probably, and that would have probably all worked out the same way, but but these are options on futures. Now, so what does that mean? You're getting leverage on leverage. That's a lot of fun.
It is. Yeah. So you got to be careful with that. Just to give you like an idea on scaling, one E-mini S&P future or option, whatever you're looking at, is roughly about $280,000 worth of stock.
Right. One. That's the,
yes, one.
That's not, is that the, that's the mini?
That's the mini. Yeah. Oh. The micro is 1/10 of that. Yeah. So you can hedge on a much smaller scale with the micros, which is awesome. But a mini will cover $250,000 of portfolio. And to margin a trade, just to give you an idea what a margin would be like, because keep in mind, your portfolio is in one account, your commodity account's another account. They're not cross margin because they're completely different regulators and it's all that kind of stuff. So you're in your futures account, if you did put on a hedge, like I mentioned before, sell the 6,100, buy the 5,100, the margin on that's about 10 grand, just to give you an idea. So you'd have to have 10 grand sitting there just to be able to put that hedge on. Even though it's free, you have to be able to cushion any losses in your futures account if we do go higher.
Right. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. You brought it up. So the god awful, this is another widowmaker trade. So the 1 minute widowmaker trade is the going long or buying the yen, thinking the yen is going to go up in value, mm-hmm, right? Against the US dollar. That has been an absolute loser. That has been the throw yourself off at the top of the building kind of trade. The other one that seems to be right in that same line is natural gas. I mean, mm-hmm, it's like, what in the world? I thought we were going to a cleaner energy. Oil's coming down. Natural gas was being used. You know, yes, we had some things that happened in Russia. We have things that happened in Middle East with all. And how is it that natural gas just cannot get going?
It just can't. Well, the problem is natural gas is not very easy to export to other countries because you have to liquefy it first, and then you have to have very specific infrastructure to ship it. And it's a whole thing. So we're slowly getting the infrastructure that needed to ship natural gas to places like Europe, but it takes years and years and years. So this isn't something that happens overnight. In the meantime, in the US, we have more natural gas than we know what to do with. They've kind of cut down on the practice now, but I mean, there a lot of companies actually basically burn it off. They have so much that it's cheaper to burn it than to send it to the market. So we're very, very well supplied in natural gas. That's the issue. But with that said, seasonality is bullish natural gas. Like we tend to get a nice little jump going into the winter season for obvious reasons. Natural gas, it bottomed out a few weeks ago around 190. Anytime we've seen natural gas get under $2, it's generally a really fantastic long-term buying opportunity. Now, can it go to 140, 160? It has a few times historically, but it never stays there. The long run is anywhere under two is probably a good buy. And so that's how we're trading it. We think we probably saw the low a few weeks ago. Now, even if we're right and that was a low, don't expect $7, $8, $9, $10.
$3 would be a modern day miracle, right?
Correct.
It's funny because every time I was always like, oh, natural gas, look at this. It looks like it's going to start on an uptrend. Let's get in. And then I'm like, what in the world? Why even bother with this? There's so many other possible things. By the way, what's the wildest, what's the wildest commodity that you have traded that you're like, that's just not going to happen anymore. I'm not doing that anymore.
Yeah. So, I mean, to be honest, every commodity market goes through its phase of just being a complete nightmare. And then you don't touch it for a while because you have PTSD and that's just how it is. Most recently, the worst situation that we've been in most recently was when Russia invaded Ukraine and the wheat market started rallying sharply. Yeah. And it was so ironic because we were positioned correctly. We had bullish trades on. Like we basically had bull call spreads. So you buy a call option, you sell a call above it. So it was a call vertical. The market rallied pretty sharply. So we thought it was good. We turned it into a ladder. We sold an extra call above to take that premium in. And when the market kept going up, we bought futures contracts against it. So on paper, we had zero upside risk. On paper, we were fine.
On paper. You keep saying the word on
played
paper.
Played it perfectly. Yeah. Played it honestly, I was kind of proud of myself because I'm like, darn, I didn't even try to stick my head in the sand. We took care of it. We managed our risk. But guess what happened? Yeah. The futures market has price limits. It could only go up 75 cents a day. Well, our short options have no price limits. So what was happening is people that were caught in the futures markets and they couldn't buy or sell futures were trading the options. Oh. Well, so the options were going, like the call options were going up as if the market was up $1.50, where the futures could only go up 75 cents because of the price limit. So even though on paper we had a trade that literally couldn't lose money on the way up, it was just shredding money and we couldn't even do anything about it. So,
but wouldn't that all eventually, well, depending on how long it is, eventually you see it would come back into a normal level, you would think.
Yeah. So eventually it would all work out. The problem is the clearing firms and the exchange wants you're wiring tens of thousands of dollars every day to meet margin calls. I mean, it was just it was super, super messy. It was fun.
Talk about gold for a second. It seems like gold is pretty good. We had gold through about mid-year. We swapped that out for a position. When I say gold, it's not in the futures. We don't do futures. We do it through various other instruments. And we had gold, we had silver on actually for about 2 years. So we got out of it about mid-year thinking, you know what, that's not the positioning we want. We want a more diversified commodities fund, 50% oil, and then smatter out the rest of it, you know, across the whole board. And silver has been kind of nowhere, but gold has been like, wow, that just keeps going, which kind of in a weird way just smacks you in the face of why. Because if you think that we're not going into recession, theoretically, that the Fed may reduce rates, but yet the dollar has been going up, generally speaking, right? And you're thinking, and we're going to have a quote-unquote soft landing, and everybody's bidding up stocks. You're like, okay, hold on. Gold should be going down. That makes sense. Okay, let me look. Yeah. Nope. What's happening? Is it India?
Well, I think
India's buying gold again?
That's probably part of it. But I think what it is gold's kind of catching up. Like gold had every reason to blow out the upside when we had, you know, we had inflation, we had geopolitical risk, we had all kinds of crazy stuff going on, and gold really couldn't go much higher. what was holding it back was the higher US dollar and higher interest rates. But now that those things are starting to resolve itself, I think we're getting some catch-up buying. We've been very persistently bullish gold for a year and a half, 2 years now. Our upside target's always been roughly in the 20, we've bumped it up a few times, but it's now, it's about 2650, and it's been 2650 for almost a year now. So we're almost there, to be honest. I think you did the right thing. Even though I think gold continues higher, because I think interest rates are probably going to continue to creep a little bit lower, and that should push gold higher, the dollar down. The upside in gold is probably at this point not as big as the downside risk. I mean, you and I were old enough to know that when gold goes into correction mode, you do not want to be long and wrong.
No.
I mean, there's no mercy there.
There or silver. Yeah. No.
Nope, exactly not. So this is the kind of market, most people think of it as a market you just buy and hold on forever, but you really don't. If you look at the pricing, there's decades where we just do nothing or lose 40% before we finally get back up to those watermark highs. So I think if you've made money on gold, pair it back. I mean, I do think we go a little higher, but the reality is when it rolls over, it's not going to be pleasant.
Yeah, you get when it rolls over, you get steamrolled is the problem.
Right, exactly.
So let's just finish up on interest rates. Do you trade Fed fund futures?
We really don't. We watch them very closely, but we don't really trade the Fed fund futures. We do a lot of 10-year note, 30-year bond stuff.
Oh, really? So what are you doing? You're doing like a pair trade or spreads?
No, we're usually just doing options. So basically, to be honest, we don't have anything on right at the moment. But any big dip in usually the 30-year is what we do it in. Any big dip in the 30-year, we'll do some sort of option spread where we're buying a call spread, selling a put. And I'm pretty comfortable selling puts underneath the market now. We've had that big explosion of volatility a few years ago. I think that's behind us. And I think we go back to, if you remember, treasuries used to be very, very boring. And I think we're going back.
We could go back to boring treasuries, don't you? Seriously.
Yeah, I do.
I mean,
I think we will.
I find this manipulation of the markets, the constant, the daily, the hourly manipulation through the, what Bernanke created, the what was it called? The transparency with the
mandate. Yeah.
That whole thing.
Honestly,
the talking points. Bad.
Yeah, he ruined the market. If you look at a monthly chart, literally when they started becoming transparent and QE and all that kind of stuff is when volatility just exploded off the chart.
Yeah, so just leave it alone. I don't want to hear about it. I would be remiss to ask you one question about your favorite, favorite potential positioning. But before we do that, tell me how people get in touch with all the things that you do.
So you can find us on social media. Just search for Carly Garner or DeCarly Trading. We're there. But website is www.decarlytrading.com. It's spelled DECARLEY trading.com.
Can I ask you what the D is for?
Yeah. So the two, myself and my business partner, we took her last name. It's DeCarlo. And my first name, which is Carly. And they just happened to, all the letters work together. So that's
perfect.
What we
went with. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
So what is your favorite, give me just generally speaking, what's your favorite, if you say, okay, in the next, 6 weeks or whatever time period, because we don't go really long on futures, what's kind of the favorite position? Is it cotton? Is it natural gas? I mean, what is it?
Right. To be honest, we're kind of light right now because markets are in transition, but you did mention cotton and that's absolutely one that we have our eye on. We have a
pretty
decent position in cotton. No, actually, believe it or not, it's really the only one that is kind of meeting our parameters. Cotton's trading around 67. We haven't seen it below 65 since, except for two times in history, and that was the COVID meltdown and the financial crisis. So unless we're going into financial crisis, 65 cents is a pretty good base. So we're basically going long futures and buying puts to protect it, just in case something weird happens. Other than that, to be honest, we're kind of in wait. I'd like to play the downside in the stock market, but I'm waiting for it to get a little bit higher.
You know, I feel like I just said that was the last thing, but I got to ask you something else. Cocoa and lumber. Now, two different things, two different areas, but like in two different time frames, dates, two different dates I'm talking about. Do you remember that whole lumber thing back in the day?
I do.
And it was like, we're all looking at going, no, that can't be right. No. And cocoa recently, right? Cocoa's berserk. Yeah. As a matter of fact, so far that Mars just bought the Kellanova. Mars, the chocolate company, is buying the snack/salty food company because for a lot of, but all $35 billion. And so the similarities are kind of eerie, aren't they? In terms of the spikes?
Yeah, it's really odd. Cocoa is a really, it's a wild animal. It's traded on a weird exchange. Like it's not traded on the Chicago Mercantile Group exchange like everything else is. The hours are weird. The margins are weird. The ICE exchange made a really big mistake during that whole cocoa fiasco several months ago. The margin requirement started at like $1,800 and they raised it to like $2,200. Well, cocoa had almost quadrupled in price and you only bumped up the margin a few hundred bucks. That was just a nightmare. So it ended up luring all these speculators in that had really didn't understand cocoa or understand futures markets probably. And we saw what happened. So, and on top of that, cocoa is grown in regions of the world that don't have a USDA. So nobody's verifying the data they're putting out and they're talking their book. And so things get out of control really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. It's an illiquid market. So if anyone's listening and you ever have the desire to trade cocoa futures, don't do it.
Yeah, don't do it.
Don't even trade. Don't do it. Nobody should touch
it. Get yourself a Snickers bar and that'll be the satisfaction 100%. You can get right there, you know?
Don't do it. I have a story. So when things were going wildly crazy up there, we knew it wasn't going to last. We knew this was just silly town, but you don't want to sell a futures contract because it was moving $10,000, $15,000 per contract a day. I mean, just stupid. So what we bought put options with tons of time thinking that would be a great play. And cocoa dropped from like 13,000 to 7,000, I want to say, while we had puts in place and we could not sell them. Like on paper, the exchange is telling us it settled at this price. It's worth this. No one would take the other side of our liquidation order. So don't even bother.
Wow. Just too thin.
Yeah. No fun.
Carly Garner, thank you so much. Hopefully we won't be years in the difference of our getting together. And I hope that the cool weather rolls in eventually into Las Vegas for you.
Thank you. Me too.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
That's going to wrap it up for this edition, the show, this episode of The Disciplined Investor. Hope you learned a lot about commodities. I always learn a lot when I talk to our guests, and this is no difference here. There was great information by Carly, so thank you for being here with us. And I'm ready to see you next week. We have another great guest coming on, Brian Dress. And then we put together a really good show that will be coming up in, I think, 2 weeks. And it's an extension of financial literacy before we get back to school, if you know what I'm saying. Before the thing starts and we get into post-Labor Day action where things really heat up, it's going to be right about then. It's going to be another great discussion about diversification, which I really put a lot of time into. We'll get that going and have that up for you in about 2 weeks. So thanks for joining me this week and every week. Go over and give us a good review. Definitely don't give us a bad review. Go over and give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, and all the other podcast apps out there. Thanks for joining me this week. Every week, I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.